Welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists and opinion makers that bridge our two worlds. My name's Chad O'Carroll and I'll be your host today. In this interview, Korean Context speaks with Dr. Jennifer Lind, Assistant Professor at the Department of Government, Dartmouth College. Well known for her work on North Korea and indeed Northeast Asia, Lin's research interests include war memory in international politics, regime change in East Asian stability, and the evolution of nationalism. She's also well known for a paper she wrote last year with Bruce Bennett of the RAND Foundation, which focused on the force requirements which would be needed in the event of a benign collapse of the Pyongyang regime. With her strong North Korea focus, in this episode we caught up with Dr. Lind about the DPRK government's resilience and whether or not it will be possible for Kim Jong-un to make substantial reforms moving forward. But before that, I started by asking Lind how she became initially interested in finding out about Korea and what it's like being one of the few women in the field.
Well, I studied international security, and I had started off being interested in East Asia because when I was in graduate school early on, Japan was the big question. So Japan is number one, and the U.S.-Japan trade battles, and so everything was Japan, Japan, Japan. So I got very interested in Asia. And then, though, I got more interested in international security of Asia. And when you're interested in international security of Asia, suddenly you need to know something about the Korean Peninsula, because that's one of the absolute most important issues for that particular topic. And then I was able to work at RAND and was assigned to a project about, much like the article that I later wrote with Bruce Bennett, military missions involved in a collapsed North Korea scenario. So I think it was the fact that there's so much interest in the Korean Peninsula, if you're in the field of international security, that it swept me up too. I got very interested in it. It's a clearly very important region to study.
Mm-hmm. And I've been sort of following it for a couple of years, and you're one of the few women I can think of that works in the field. Like, do you think there are any reasons why there are so few female analysts in the field of security, but specifically with regards to North Korea issue?
There are lots of really smart, talented women in the field of security. Whether or not they're being promoted and well represented is a totally different issue. It's true that there are not so many women in East Asian international security, but even then there are many. With respect to the Korean Peninsula, I'm always struck when I go to Korea that I feel like I'm going into the world of men. I get on the airplane and it's all men, and I get off the airplane and I go to my conference and it's all men. And I think partly it's because, at least a lot of the reasons why Americans go over there, they're either businessmen or they're doing something for the military. And so if you're particularly doing the latter, it's most likely going to be a man who's doing this. And then, of course, if you're in the field of studying contingency planning and things like this, you're dealing a lot with the military. And again, this is very much feels like the world of men. I'm always encouraging people to try and reach out to women who are in the field. And this is something that I think, particularly at American conferences, people are starting to realize they have the power to affect in terms mm-hmm. of whom they invite. And I have actually been to conferences where they specifically said, we are going to create gender balance at this conference. And they had no problem whatsoever doing that once mm-hmm. they set that goal. The women are there. I don't see that this is a goal, shall I put it mildly, that is shared when I go to conferences in Asia, where I'm usually the only woman in the room, maybe one of two or three at the most out of, it can be a couple hundred. So I definitely do stand out, but people have been very interested in my work, And, you know, that's something that I find very gratifying.
Okay, moving on. Having written extensively on authoritarian resilience, I'd like to ask you about information inflows into North Korea. Some say if information flowing into North Korea about the outside world can be increased, then the chances for regime change or collapse to occur will also increase. But then I often wonder if these same people remember, you know, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, Bashar al-Assad's Syria up until a year or so ago, where open information was tolerated to a much greater degree than in North Korea. And fair enough, those regimes are either dead or dying right now. But they nevertheless had a long period where they were, you know, able to get away with murder, quite literally. So do you think that case for information inflows is at all overstated?
It's definitely a risk. Again, in this article that I wrote with Daniel Byman, we tried to enumerate from history and from this theory of authoritarian resilience, what are the various tools that dictators use to stay in power? And information control is a very important tool. And kind of wedded to that is you create your own narrative, your own story of why you deserve to be in power and no one else does. In order to foster your legitimacy domestically. So it's this kind of marriage of both information control and giving the people this narrative that justifies you staying in power. If you lose control over information, therefore, this means that tool is weakened. So you have one less tool or you have a far weaker tool than you did relative to the days where you could completely control the information that people had. So that's I think, not a point of debate. I think most people agree that, you know, ceteris paribus, more information control means a safer position for the dictator. At the same time, though, as I said, it's just one tool. And right. There's a lot of tools in that toolkit, and the use of force, repression, surveillance, all of those very powerful, very scary and menacing tools that the regime in North Korea enjoys, those are very powerful tools for the regime. And people could wake up every day and look at the portraits of the Kim family on the wall and curse them in their minds and despair about their situation and think about how much they hate their government. But at the same time, in a society that promises to kill them, and not only them, but their families, if they act out, they're going to get up and go to work that day. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to speak for every North Korean, but basically it's basically my goal in life to make sure my kids are safe. Mm-hmm. And the last thing in the world that I would do is something that would make my kids not safe. So it is a powerful thing when you go after people's families, and that regime is quite good at doing that. As I said, though, there's always revolutions over history. People act out, people stand up, people march, people rally. So we know that there are, at times, individuals who take a stand. There are times when it's easier to take a stand. And in North Korea, we know it's a very, very difficult thing to do. It was far easier, for example, in Tunisia or in Syria, or many of these other countries in Eastern Europe that underwent these revolutions. So it's this human element, of course, that means we can never completely say, well, of course, no one will rebel against this regime, because our theories don't cover the Tunisian street vendor who has had enough and decides to set off the Arab Spring with his dissent. So again, it's very, very much a science to study the resilience of dictators, but we have to admit that there is a very strong element of humanity that's in there, well, that's also in there, that makes it a very difficult thing to make predictions about.
Right. And a year on from your paper on North Korean collapse scenarios, have you had any inclinations since writing what those collapse scenarios might be brought on by? I know it wasn't your your intention to hypothesize about those in the paper, but just, you know, maybe in the back of your mind you've had a brainwave in the last year.
I hope I've had a few. That paper was motivated basically in the idea that a government collapse in North Korea would be so dangerous that even if you thought the odds of it happening were pretty low, it's such a dangerous scenario and such a complex problem to be managed by so many different countries that were not really engaged in talking to one another. So even if you thought it wasn't going to happen, it's still worth studying because, frankly, it's the sort of thing that could happen, as we know from looking at, you know, the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. It could happen at any time. Now, that said, when we wrote the paper, we were looking toward secession in North Korea. And we do know that secession is one of the most difficult challenges that an authoritarian regime has to go through. So secession is a particular danger time. And so when we wrote the paper, we said, okay, Kim Jong-il is getting a little bit old and he's not looking so good. He had this stroke in 2008. Gosh, it just doesn't look like he's really been laying the groundwork for succession. Nobody's really quite sure who the designated successor even is. So given that, there is actually a higher risk of regime collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were thinking that this is something that would happen within the next, you know, 10 years or something like this. Little did we know that we would write the paper and Kim Jong-il would actually die while the paper is actually in the current issue of the journal in fall 2011. So again, I thought I would be talking about that paper and the upcoming succession in North Korea for, you know, a good 5 years or so.
Right.
And the succession came right away. So this is an important update for our paper. Number one is it looks as if the regime successfully transitioned. So that when we wrote the paper, that was a huge question mark. And so now what we can say just a year later is, okay, the regime has succeeded in surmounting one of these really big challenges that were coming at it. So that's an important piece of information in this whole conversation about North Korean collapse. But as you're saying, there's lots of other questions that people should be asking. And in terms of, particularly, as I said, if we do indeed see increased reform in North Korea, if we see economic reform, if we see greater information flows, if we see easing up of repression against the North Korean people, what we know from history, again, as I said, about the post-totalitarian period being a more vulnerable time for dictators,
mm-hmm.
what we know from history says, dust off the contingency plans.
Mm-hmm.
Collapse is not a foregone conclusion by any means. The Chinese managed to do this, and the CCP stayed in power despite the transition. So collapse is not inevitable, but it's another time when there is a heightened risk.
And if you were to counsel Kim Jong-un on history now, would you point him to any transitions, such as China perhaps, as one that you would recommend would be the best to emulate?
I guess what I would be telling him to do is to put my best analysts on this question of, is a Chinese-style transition possible for North Korea? Because that is one of these huge questions that we're all very interested in right now. I haven't actually seen this satisfactorily debated to the extent that we should be debating it, because this is, I mean, there's a whole set of security questions to ask about North Korea, But I think domestically, this is the question to be asking about North Korea. Could they do a China-style reform? When you look back to China in the days of Mao, there are a lot of similarities with North Korea. It is not the place that it is today. That country has evolved substantially. And so we've seen this remarkable transition in China over the past, 30, 40 years. And so the question is, can North Korea do it? The answer that I get when I ask people who know the Chinese economic reform and the North Korean economy well, the answer that I get is North Korea can't do it because of South Korea, because opening up is going to show the people that there's this preferable model, that there's a far more successful model down south, and that will be the end of the regime. I think we need to talk about this more. I think we need to debate this more and have the experts in China's economy and Chinese economic reform help us with this conversation. Because, China didn't have a South China, but they did have a whole successful world out there that, as they gave their people the means to access it and view it, they had alternatives that would be available to the Chinese people. Mm-hmm. And yet they transitioned in this manner. I can't even use the word successfully. It was so amazingly successfully, historically unprecedented successfully, right? They certainly pulled this off, and the CCP managed to stay in power. So that's the question that Kim Jong-un should be asking of his top analysts is, can we do this? What are the reasons why we think that there's something unique about our situation that means we can't? Or what are the reasons why we think we could actually get away with this and move this country into a new era?
And just to round up, if Kim Jong-un's top analyst did look into this and said, look, we can't do it, what then? We just see a continuation of status quo until it grinds to a halt, whenever that might be.
Everybody's been talking about the grinding to a halt for a long time now.
Right.
and again, just because you're poor doesn't mean you collapse. I guess that's the tagline of the article I wrote with Daniel Byman. There are a lot of impoverished governments that manage to stay in power, and they do so using all of these tools that we talk about. They do so in many creative ways, such as extorting and begging for money from foreign supporters. And so one question that you're interested in knowing is, what's China's attitude going to be toward North Korea in the future? It's a major patron of North Korea. And if it stays that way, I think North Korea can keep limping along as it has. I mean, Marcus Noland wrote the famous article about North Korea muddling through, and that was late 1990s. Mm. So we're still having this conversation, and North Korea is still muddling through. So how is it muddling through? It's muddling through by repressing its domestic population and by begging for money from other countries. And for a while, successfully extorting money from other countries, trying to essentially sell its nuclear program. In other words, to sell promises to give up its nuclear program. We sincerely hope it's not actually selling its nuclear program, because that would be another way to raise money that would be grievously destabilizing from an international standpoint. So basically, my point is, this country has shown it can limp along quite successfully through this strategy of reliance on charity from China. And all indications suggest that China is going to keep the same relationship of basically trying to keep this regime in power, because the alternative of letting it collapse is just horrifying to the Chinese. This could be very destabilizing along its southern border. So basically, I think this strategy shows promise for the future.
Mm.
This strategy of muddling through, relying on aid. I think the strategy of the promises, trading the promises, of giving away your nukes, you know, trading that for aid. I think that well's kind of dried up. I don't think that the United States is interested in extending more aid in exchange for what clearly will be broken promises to give up the nuclear program. So that's one aspect of it that I think is different. But in terms of the support from China, I think North Korea's got the ATM, and the ATM's open for business, and there's no reason to think that it won't be in the near future.
Great. Well, thanks very much for participating in today's Korean Context.
Thanks a lot, Chad. It was a real pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you're interested in hearing more about Dr. Lin's work on the Koreas, you may wish to check out an additional part of this interview that's been transcribed and hosted on the KEI blog website, which you can find at blog.keia.org. That's blog.keia.org. And if you'd like to contact her directly, you can find her on Twitter at Prof Lind. That's PROFLIND. You can download other episodes at our podcast website, which you can find at keia.podbean.com. That's keia.podbean.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could leave us some feedback using the comment system on either the Podbean website or directly on our iTunes page. If you'd like to suggest a candidate or topic for a future episode, be sure to drop me an email at ocarroll@keia.org. That's ocarroll@keia.org. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you can join us next time.